I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The NRA's Firearm Safety Program, Eddie Eagle, could be coming into Kansas public schools. Today, the Kansas State Senate has approved several bills that would extend the rights of gun owners in the state, but some of the provisions go beyond the right to carry firearms. We'll get reactions from legislators about these bills and ask what they do to protect Second Amendment rights. Later, flag football is gaining popularity. This could be a relief for parents worried about concussion in contact sports. Studies show that these head injuries have greater effect during developmental years. We'll ask if flag football is a safe alternative. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. In Kansas schools, a future curriculum could include math, reading, and guns. The NRA's Eddie Eagle program that teaches firearm safety could become standard fare. But why? We'll talk about it in our first half today. Later, is flag football a safer way to navigate the gridiron? First up today, we recap developments in the Derek Chauvin trial this week in Minneapolis. Chauvin's on trial for the death of George Floyd last summer. With us once again is Sean O'Brien. He's a professor at the UMKC School of Law. Sean, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You know, the big news this week out of this trial, it seems to me, was Derek Chauvin's decision not to testify on his own behalf. Smart decision or not, Sean?
I think that's typically a smart decision for a criminal defendant. A lot of the defense is going to be that it's the state's burden of proof. And I think it's when you put the defendant on the stand, the jury may go back and just decide, do we believe him or not? And of course, there are issues that'll come out on cross-examination, such as it may open the door to three prior incidents involving Officer Chauvin that the jury hasn't yet heard about, but they might if he takes the witness stand. So, you know, he shot a fellow in 2006 and killed him, and then there were two non-fatal shootings before this one. And so I think it's a smart decision.
But isn't there ultimately kind of a presumption that something's amiss if you don't testify in your own behalf, Sean?
Well, not really. I mean, you know, yes, there is. People say, well, if he's innocent, he would take the stand. But American law is very protective of that decision. So the defense can have the jury told you can draw no inference whatsoever from the fact that he didn't testify because the burden of proof is on the prosecution.
Yeah, but they can say that in court, though, Sean, but the jury goes by impressions, not by what they're told to think and not think.
Well, that's true. That's true. When I'm, you know, when I defend a case, I have put clients on the stand and I've kept them off the stand. I wait until the very end of the case and I think, have I established what I want to establish? And it's sort of like playing blackjack at this point. If they think they've got 18 or 19 showing, they're not going to say hit me, you know, because you can lose significant ground by putting the defendant on the stand. And in this case, I think it is significant ground for the jury to hear about prior fatalities, or not actually prior use of fatal force, only one of which involved and resulted in a fatality.
How effective a job did the defense do this week, Sean, in your view?
Well, I think we'll find out next week, but I think that, you know, this is a battle of experts is what they've succeeded in turning the case into. On the issue of causation. And part of it was a subtle backdoor way of blaming the victim here. You know, George Floyd's drug use is all over the defense case. And so that's a way not only of raising questions about causation. I mean, one of the things the prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt is that what Derek Chauvin did caused the death of George Floyd. And so they're raising every specter they can, his heart disease, his drug use, and they even talked about exhaust from the police car, this real close to his face as he's lying on the ground. And so that's kind of their approach. And when you get into the battle of the experts and the jury gets back there and they're so confused, they don't know who to believe. sometimes the experts just drop out of the case, and then the jury asks, well, who has the burden of proof on this issue? And so a tie goes to the defense if that's what they succeed in doing. And so that appears to be the strategy here. I mean, we'll see if it works. But, you know, the prosecution has a strong point. And I think they made it on cross-examination pretty well, which is if George Floyd just walked down the street, he was not going to spontaneously drop over dead at that moment. There's clearly some relationship. And the law of causation that I think, you know, hopefully the prosecutor
What is that causation? You're using that phrase here. What does that mean, Sean?
Causation means that the act of the defendant had to cause the death. And that's essentially an element of murder that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And so there's all kinds of parallel doctrines to that about intervening causes or independent causes. If I were the prosecution, I would be asking for a jury instruction on the law of causation to the jury, because all of these things, even if they had existed, the question is, did the acts of the defendant add to the pre-existing risk? Were all of these factors operating in connection with one another? And if that's the case, he's still guilty, you know?
I'm visiting with Sean O'Brien. He's a professor at the UMKC School of Law about the Derek Chauvin trial this week. What do you think we can expect from closing arguments that'll take place on Monday, Sean?
Well, I think the prosecution, of course, is going to focus on the videotape and the time element. That's really their strongest argument. And that is, you know, you're a police officer and you've put this person on the ground. He's clearly subdued and he has a responsibility to see to his safety. And the question is, did placing him on the ground kill him? No. But holding him there for that period of time while people are telling him they're observing the life leaving George Floyd's body, that's going to be a hard thing for the defense to get around. And that's where the prosecution is going to spend a lot of its effort. And they'll spend some, and that in itself does a lot to, you know, at some point he had an obligation to get up and render life-saving medical treatment, or at least allow others to do that. And that's the prosecution's strongest point. The defense, I think, is going to come back with the causation argument, the heart disease. But I think that you'll hear them talking mostly about the drugs. There's a real strong blame the victim element here. And I hate to say it, but there is an appeal to the bias and prejudices of jurors in a big piece of that defense. And, you know, so I think we'll look to see if the police officers' lawyers manage to trigger some of that bias.
So, Sean, the jury has a decision to make here. Is it going to be second-degree murder, third-degree murder, or second-degree manslaughter? What is the jury going to have to consider here as it weighs these different options?
Well, a second-degree murder, the statute says that he has to cause the death of a human being with intent to effect the death of that person. That's probably the hardest for the prosecution to prove, that he intended to cause the death. That if the jury finds him guilty of that, that's 40 years, potentially a 40-year sentence. I doubt that they go there, but third-degree murder, this is why the third degree murder issue was so important. They took it all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court before the trial. And that statute says whoever, without intent to effect the death of any person, causes the death of another person by perpetrating an act imminently dangerous to others and evincing a depraved mind without regard to human life. That's a common law standard that sometimes called the depravity of mind standard. You don't have to intend to cause the death, but you have a reckless indifference to human life.
How many years do you get for that, Sean?
He could get up to 25 years for that and a fine of up to $40,000. And that, I think where we'll see the prosecution exist. I mean, I think they may even concede away second degree murder, but focus on the conviction of third degree murder. And then there's manslaughter. And the defense might even make a little side argument. I don't think they'll spend a lot of time here, but the second degree manslaughter is a person acts with culpable negligence and creates an unreasonable risk and consciously takes chances of causing death or great bodily harm. And so the consciously taking the chance of causing death is really the contested issue here.
Sean, I just have a little bit of time left here. Where do you think we're going to go? Do you want to make a prediction here?
I'm going to wait and see the closing argument before I make a prediction. I think the prosecution is hoping for manslaughter, or I'm sorry, for second degree murder. The defense is hoping for acquittal, and I think the defendant will feel lucky if he gets manslaughter in the second degree. Mm-hmm. But I want to watch the closing argument, and because there's always this element, what are the values of the jury? How well did each side select people to hear the case?
Right.
And so I would have blown the prediction, for example, on George Zimmerman's trial. I called the OJ trial, right? I said a quick acquittal. But that's, I benefited greatly from watching the closing argument.
All right.
So right now it's anybody's guess, Steve.
That's Sean O'Brien. He's a professor at the UMKC School of Law. Sean, sure appreciate your insights. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, great. I look forward to it.
You bet. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Kansas lawmakers are close to passing a bill that could lead to K-12 students taking gun safety classes. Under the legislation, elementary students would use the NRA's Eddie Eagle courses, while high school students would be taught a State Department of Parks and Wildlife class. The Kansas Board of Education doesn't appear to be too keen on this idea. Board members say it's their call on what kids learn in school, not the legislature's. And some Democrats don't like it either, calling the measure an NRA marketing tool to entice kids into gun ownership. With us now to talk about this is Kansas State Senator Dinah Sykes. She's a Lenexa Democrat and a Senate Minority Leader. She calls herself a champion of gun safety education, but doesn't want to add to the workload of public school teachers. Senator Sykes, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Also with us is Stephen Caranda. He's a State House reporter for the Kansas News Service. Stephen, welcome back. Good to have you.
Good morning.
We invited several Republican proponents of this measure to join us today, but didn't get any takers. And we'd like to know what our listeners think of this idea of requiring the teaching of gun safety classes to K-12 students in Kansas. Our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Well, Senator, how unusual is this that the legislature is engaging in a school curriculum issue involving the National Rifle Association?
Well, for first, I think the legislature dealing with curriculum has been kind of the standard this year. We've passed several pieces of legislation,
right,
civics test, financial literacy, and gun safety. So we are not staying in our lane. I find this one, all of them are not terrible programs, but this should be the State Board of Education who's making this decision. The Eddie Eagle and the NRA, this one is more appalling because not only have we passed this legislation, but we passed legislation for a specialized license plate where taxpayer dollars are actually going to be going to the NRA. And during debate on several bills, election bills, Republican legislators did not want the League of Women Voters in our schools, signing up seniors to register to vote. But then on the other hand, we're passing legislation to put the NRA in our schools and also to send taxpayer funds their way.
Stephen Caranda, this education plan is in conjunction with a bill that would expand the right of people as young as 18 to carry concealed firearms. So are the two ideas sort of going arm in arm here?
Well, not exactly. They're two separate issues that are both kind of advancing right now. Both of these issues have been talked about in the past, and especially the Eddie Eagle bill has been talked about in the past. One thing I want to clarify is this bill does not require school districts to offer gun safety training. But what it says is if you're going to, you have to use these programs, we say. And for younger students, that would be this NRA Eddie Eagle program or a subsequent program. For older students, it could be Eddie Eagle or some state hunter safety programs. And, you know, I talked with one of the main proponents of this, Republican Patrick Penn, and his argument is this Eddie Eagle program is, as he calls it, the gold standard for gun safety programs. So it makes sense to say if schools are going to offer gun safety, they should use this. And really part of this, which was talked about in committee in the House, is that some lawmakers brought up anecdotally the idea that schools would maybe be offering gun training that they would see as anti-gun or would maybe encourage kids to tell the school that their parents have guns. And this was a way to nip that in the bud. Say, if you're going to offer school training, it has to be this NRA program.
Senator Sykes, how many school districts across the state, just roughly, I mean, how many would you expect would end up offering these gun safety classes?
You know, I don't know a specific number, and I think it would vary. There is nothing stopping gun safety in our school districts right now. This is just saying that it has to be this specific program.
Any sense of how many schools are offering gun safety classes now then?
I do not know the answer to that.
Yeah. Why do you think, Senator, the NRA is pushing this legislation?
You know, the cynic in me says, you know, they've got a very different legislature right now, and they can push their agenda. For the last 4 years, we have not debated really any gun bills, with the exception of keeping guns out of our hospitals and mental health facilities. But this year, it's a different legislature, and, you know, we are putting special interest opinions above Kansans, in my opinion.
Stephen Caranda, who's this bill named after?
Well, I believe the Royale Act, is that right? That was added this year, and the idea there is naming it after someone who died from gun violence, maybe with the hope that this could prevent future tragedies like that.
Can you describe, Stephen, the level of support these bills seem to have in both the state House and the Senate?
So this is where it gets tricky, because these both passed easily, but they did not pass with enough votes to override a veto in both chambers. Even some Republicans have raised concerns about the state lawmakers setting curriculum standards, and that's been the opposition also from the Board of Education, saying this is up to local school districts and the Board of Ed, not state lawmakers. So the Board of Ed is even bringing their concerns to the governor without explicitly telling her to veto the bill, telling her that they're concerned about it and they're concerned about other bills lawmakers have passed that say you have to teach XYZ classes in school. So, for example, if the governor does choose to veto it, it has enough votes in the Senate to override that veto, but it does not in the House. It's, I think, 5 short. So if she vetoes it, there's going to have to be some serious vote whipping in the House to try to get enough to override.
You know, Senator Sykes, the governor's a member of your party, of course, as a Democrat here, and she has a record as a state senator of being, you know, friendly and open to the idea of some gun legislation that got her in hot water when she ran for the gubernatorial nomination. Has she said what she's going to do with this bill should it reach her desk?
She does not tell us prior to when we pass legislation how she will, either if she'll veto it or let it go into law. So we have open conversations and I share my concerns, but she doesn't tip her hand.
She doesn't wink at you or anything like that, Senator?
No, she doesn't. I kind of wish she did sometimes.
The governor will occasionally make comments critical of a bill that you can kind of infer as meaning she'll veto it. But she has basically a rule where she will never say, I'm going to veto a bill until she actually does it.
And Stephen, do you agree with Senator Sykes that she tipped her hand in any of those comments you're talking about there?
She really hasn't on this one. I'm thinking more specifically of like the trans athlete bill that we've been hearing a lot about. She roundly criticized that this week at an event, but stopped short of saying she would veto it. but she has not said as much about this bill. She's raised some concerns about other gun bills. So my thinking is she's more likely to veto this gun training bill than let it become law. But that's just a guess based on opposition from Democrats and concern generally about lawmakers setting school policies.
Senator Sykes, how controversial is this bill? How much interest are you getting on this issue in Topeka?
You know, out of all of the legislation, we've gotten some, but not a lot on this. And most of it is, I think, trying from teachers or the state board saying, you know, this is really not your avenue. Let us do our job. If you wanted to be on this decide curriculum, you know, run for the State Board of Education, not for the Senate.
I'm wondering, for either of you, if a school district implements the gun safety as part of its curriculum, you know, if a parent doesn't want a son or a daughter to take the course, is there an option there? Stephen, do you have any feel for that? Am I getting too far in the weeds here?
I can't remember the answer to that. Senator Sykes, do you know, on a lot of things like this could be offered optionally?
I think it would be optional. Exactly. I believe you could opt out. It would not be required, but that is getting into the weeds. And honestly, I think we did kind of leave that up to the state board.
Mm-hmm. Senator, you made a couple of points on the floor last week about this legislation that I wanted to ask you about. One of them was this idea that children in this country die from gunfire at a higher rate than any other industrial nation. What was your point there in terms of how that this relates to the gun safety class?
Well, Steve, we have not had, you know, honest conversations about how to reduce gun violence, especially now during a pandemic when mental health is an issue. We don't have those conversations about, you know, passing legislation to hold people responsible if they are not keeping their guns in with gun locks or in safes. Let's have that conversation instead of putting the onus on children. You know, it should be gun owners and gun manufacturers who are being held responsible, not children who may find something that they're curious about.
You also objected to the idea that protecting kids from these lethal weapons should be dumped on teachers who are already have a heavy workload. What's your concern on that front?
We require a lot of our teachers. And, you know, I look back at what my own kids' teachers this year have done and how they have accommodated my kids during a pandemic and doing all of this. You know, to add gun safety, they may or may not be gun owners. Why are we requiring them to do this? You know, they became teachers because they have a love for children. They want to teach them math, science. We talk a lot in our education committee on how do we increase those students at risk? How do we get them to grade level? Why don't we put our concern on that instead of gun safety? Let's work to make our kids the best in the country because of our education system.
Well, if kids aren't going to learn this stuff in school, Senator, where would you have students begin to understand guns and what they're all about?
Well, I believe it belongs to the parents, but also, you know, we don't require training in general for gun ownership. And I think that's important to have, you know, safety to talk about that, but put it for someone who is trained in that, not a teacher. And not that a teacher couldn't be trained, but that's probably not where their special interest is. And if they are, that's great. But, you know, I have family members who have guns and they talk to my children about that. And that's important. But I want it to be someone that I know or it has received the qualifications to teach that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about a bill that would require the teaching of an NRA-sanctioned curriculum for Kansas students in districts that allow it. I'm visiting with State Senator Dinah Sykes. She's a Lenexa Democrat, the Senate Minority Leader. Stephen Caranda is with the Kansas News Service. Stephen, so I guess the bottom line is here, in theory, we could have teachers talking about gun safety to even kindergartners here, right?
Yeah, what the bill says is if you're going to offer training for students, grades kindergarten through five would have to be based on the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe program from the NRA or any successor program. Grades six through eight would be Eddie Eagle or various hunter safety programs, including some from the state. And then for older kids, it'd be other programs as well. The only thing I would add is, you know, you can find some of the Eddie Eagle program on YouTube. It's been posted there by the NRA. I've watched some of the videos. They're basically, you know, a computer animated cartoon with animals finding a gun and talking about don't touch it, tell an adult, singing a little song about it. So, you know, there's some of the information that's easy to find if you're interested to see what these programs would include.
Senator, is there any concern here that this could be ultimately a subtle promotion of the NRA?
Absolutely. And just as I mentioned earlier, you know, the NRA is having a lot of wins in the Kansas legislature this year, you know, getting a Gadsden flag where the proceeds will go to the NRA. This program that has a donate button right on the Eddie Eagle website that you're donating. And it is no secret that there are members of the Kansas Senate who get ratings based on the NRA and they get donations.
I want to emphasize something here, Senator. You're not anti-gun, if I understand correctly. Can you describe sort of where you are with that?
That's correct. No, not anti-gun at all. Like I said, I've grown up in a home with guns, family members who have them. But I think we need to have appropriate training and showing responsibility for those gun ownership. And, you know, I absolutely believe that gun locks and gun safes are an important part of that equation. And unfortunately, we have not been able to have those discussions because anytime you talk about common sense gun legislature, whether it's red flag laws, I introduced a bill trying to keep guns out of the hands of domestic violence offenders who are legally not allowed to have guns, but there's a loophole. We haven't addressed how they turn those guns in, but it's always, they're just trying to take away my guns. And that is not the case. It's how do we make our society safer and have the appropriate respect for guns.
Stephen, what's the State Board of Education saying about this legislation? Has it asked Governor Kelly to veto the bill, or what are they doing?
They discussed this at their most recent meeting, and they kind of lumped this in with several other bills. The lawmakers also passed bills doing things like, I believe, requiring financial education. And so members of the Board of Ed said, look, it's up to us and local school boards to set these standards, not state lawmakers to just vote on what kids should be taught. So they stopped short of explicitly asking the governor to veto it, but they did vote to send one of their members to meet with the governor and basically say, here's our concerns on all the different legislation they've passed. It should be up to us to decide this. And actually, the chair of the board, Jim Porter, said, you know, he had been in schools that offered gun safety training. He wasn't opposed to gun safety training. He's opposed to lawmakers saying, you got to use this program in schools.
So they're not saying, Governor, veto these bills, but they are sort of raising some objections here, right?
So some of the members wanted to go farther and explicitly tell her to veto these bills. And others, other board members said, well, us raising opposition is enough. She should be able to understand from that we would like her to veto it.
Let's go to some phone calls. 816-235-2888. Phil from Kansas City, Missouri. Phil, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you very much. I called to ask for a discussion of guns as a health issue, and remind folks that the CDC had tried to study this as a health issue and was banned from doing so. But I think it should belong in health education.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Phil. And there's a group in town, Aim for Peace, that approaches this issue as a public health concern. Senator, any thoughts there?
No, I think that's a very valid point. And I know Senator Boyer had legislation that tried to get hearings and we're not able to have that. But it is a health issue. And I know Representative Owsley has had a bill over the, I think, the last 5 years saying if you wanted, you felt concerned for your own life and it was being able to sign an order that you could not purchase guns, we can't even have those discussions because the other side of the aisle is so adamant that you should have a gun at any time, anywhere, as many as you want. But it is a health issue. And I think we need more people who are requiring and asking their legislators to have open conversations and compromise on legislation, because I think it is possible.
Stephen, where do we stand with the bill that would expand the right of people as young as 18 to carry concealed firearms? Where does that stand?
If memory serves, that has now passed, and we are waiting again to see what the governor does with it. Senator Sykes might remember better than me. I've been covering so many different
things. Yeah, no,
I
totally get that.
But both chambers and is now going to the governor.
Yes, that is on the governor's desk.
And do I understand right, Senator, at some point, either in the House or the Senate, someone offered an amendment to raise the age to 19 so that these weapons wouldn't be in high schools or face that possibility? What happened there?
It failed on party lines. And I will say that because they are not allowed in our schools, but the concern was at parties. If an 18-year-old was at a party, may or may not have alcohol there. That was the concern. There is provision in statutes that they cannot be on school grounds.
Yes, right. Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. Yeah, absolutely.
There actually was a lot of discussion about that in debates because it's a really sticky legal question because of some things in federal law that say if you are allowed to carry a concealed weapon in certain cases, you can bring them in schools. So there was a concern that if a student brought a gun to school and they had this license, obviously the school could expel them because they would be violating a school policy. But in some cases, they might not necessarily be breaking the law.
Steve from Lawrence. Steve, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, I just want to make a comment about whose interest is being served in this case. I've got two kids that are in rural Kansas, grandkids in rural Kansas schools. And I know when they go over to a friend's house and play a video game, immediately they come home and, oh, I want one of those. I have to think that gun training, nothing would more further their desire to have their own guns, which they and their parents, we don't have any in our homes. Quite obviously, the interest of the NRA is being served, and we all know that they've been a political pressure group for 40 years. They're
right.
Not about gun safety. They were when I was a kid. 40 years now, they've been all about political pressure, and that's
Steve, let me just get a comment here from Senator Sykes. Whose interest is being served is Steve's question, Senator.
It is the NRA, absolutely.
Okay. Let me grab one more call here. Joan from Prairie Village. Joan, you're on Up to Date.
Yes, I just wondered if there's been any information given to the Senate and House about other countries and how they handle this kind of thing. Countries like Switzerland and Canada where people do have guns.
Senator?
That was not debated on the Senate floor, and I do not serve on Fed and State, but looking at testimony, I do not believe that they looked at what other countries are doing.
Okay.
I sat in the House committee on this, and I also do not remember that issue specifically being brought up.
Okay. That hopefully answers Joan's question. I want to thank Kansas State Senator Dinah Sykes, a Lenexa Democrat, the Senate Minority Leader. Senator, sure appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Stephen Carand is a State House reporter for Kansas News Service. Stephen, always appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
After a short break, we'll be back to talk about another, maybe a safer way to play football, and that's flag football. But is it as safe as we might think it is? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Football at both the pro and amateur levels has taken a lot of hits lately, if you'll excuse the pun. Concerns over head trauma and concussion has caused a lot of people to think twice about the game and its future. But more than ever, parents are recognizing the value of exercise. So what's an alternative to football as we know it? Say hello to flag football. You remember what that is. Instead of violently hitting other players to bring them down, you tackle them by removing a hanging flag or a strip of cloth. But is flag football a safer alternative for staying active? With us to talk about it, our Chi-Min Wong is a neurobiologist and a professor at the UMKC School of Biological Sciences. Professor Huang, nice to have you back. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve.
Kason Matthews is also here. He's a senior sports director for the YMCA. Kason, nice to have you too. Good morning.
Good morning.
Kason, is flag football the answer here for kids who still want to play football, but maybe without the fear that they're going to suffer a concussion?
I truly believe so, and I think there's more to it as well. You know, I think you learn a lot from the game of flag football that you may not get to learn until you get to the middle school and high school level of playing tackle football. For example, I have second grade teams that are already running full spread offenses, running routes, and actually throwing the ball. Whereas
wow.
If you were playing tackle football, you probably wouldn't get to that till maybe sixth, seventh, or eighth grade. So I'm actually really excited to see how flag football develops the high school game whenever these kids get to that level. I think the tackle and hitting aspect can be taught at that age. And I think it just benefits the people involved more, too, is that you have better trained people working with your child at that mm-hmm. age, and you get more practice time with those kind of coaches to learn those skills.
Professor Huang, what do you think? Lend us your medical expertise here. Is flag football safe, or what do you think?
Definitely. I think there's a new publication coming out as we speak. It's a CDC study in which they not only compare a head injury and other type of injury in people who play tackle versus flat football, mm-hmm. but they also use head impact sensor to get an idea about what kind of a magnitude of the head impact they're getting. The message is that flag football is not only safer with fewer injuries, but people who play flag football, they experience far smaller magnitude of head impact than tackle football.
But doctor, just to be clear here, there are still concerns about concussions then, even in flag football though, right?
Yes, that is true. That is true. Anytime when you go outdoor, play in the mud and so on and so forth, there's always a chance for injuries.
But there's concerns about concussions in almost any sport, isn't there, doctor? Even swimming, if you bang your head against the wall when you're making a turn.
That is true. Even in synchronized swimming, there's incidences of head injuries.
And just to chime in there, sorry to interrupt, but I actually got a concussion. I was a state cross-country runner, and I ran in college. I actually got a concussion running cross-country in a meet one time.
How did you manage that, Kason?
Yeah, I know, right? I overheated. I ran into a windmill on the course, and then I fell on the back, and I obviously landed on my head. So I got a concussion running cross-country. So I think there's obviously concern for concussion protocol anytime you're outside, kind of like he's saying.
Kason, I don't mean to make fun. You ran into a windmill. Help me there.
Yeah, so it was one of our biggest meets of the year, and I really pushed myself, and it was extremely hot this day. I just overheated, lost consciousness, ran right into a windmill, and then obviously landed on the back of my head. I just remember I was doing really good at the time. So I just remember waking up in the back of an ambulance. I was like, geez, like, what, did I win? Wow. But obviously I did it.
Well, I guess sort of the bottom line here then, Kason, is there's risk in anything, and parents have to navigate how much risk they're willing to accept here.
Yeah, I think there is too. And I think it's kind of case by case as well. You know, if your child's a position player, like he's a quarterback or receiver, he or she would get more reps in flag football at those positions with less risk is my biggest thing. Now, if you know your child is probably going to be a lineman or something like that, it may benefit you to go ahead and start letting them work on the tackling aspect of the game. Or even if they are that lineman, you know, let them have fun and play flag football without the bigger risk of playing tackle football would be my viewpoint of it.
Yeah. I guess, Professor Huang, an even more basic question here might be, what about the benefits of staying active at a young age here? Because that needs to be addressed here as well, the other side of this coin.
Yes, Steve, that is for sure. The human nervous system is fantastically capable of learning new things when in youth. So that period is a golden period for learning things, anything from language, motor skills, and so on. So athletic skills, athleticism certainly would benefit the person a whole lot if that were to start young.
Huh. You know, I can't help but wonder about the popularity, Kason, of flag football. What are you seeing these days? How much interest is there in it? How is participation changing?
It's grown significantly. I think when I started with the Kansas City YMCA 6 years ago, we were averaging about 500 players, and now we're in the 2,000 range per season.
Wow.
And it's actually growing to the girl level. Like, we have all girls teams playing now, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but it is now a college sponsorship sport for NAIA levels for college athletes for women. So the popularity of flag football has really grown quite a bit.
When did that happen? When did it reach the collegiate ranks?
This is the first year, actually. And then University of St. Mary's here locally has a college flag football team.
Huh. No kidding. It's cheaper, too, right? You don't need to buy all the equipment, Case. And so it comes with some benefits for parents out there.
Oh, yeah. So you don't have to buy. That's the other thing. You don't have to buy equipment like the pads or anything like that. Really, you just need the flag belt, which normally the league provides for you. And then anything else, that's on you. Like, if you want receiver gloves, obviously you'd buy that if you wanted that. But that's really all you need is the flag belt.
Do the kids still wear helmets?
That's optional at this point. You know, I actually have some players that have had concussions from other sports like basketball and stuff to where they wear their own padded helmet and everything they do. But at that point, it's still optional right now.
Well, Professor, the helmet is something that you have focused a whole lot on. In fact, you talked about it on this program once before. What's the latest we're learning about helmet safety and what we can do to prevent football injuries with helmets? What are you working on right now?
Well, about the helmet, in a nutshell, I think most experts would agree that helmets, they do not really provide adequate protection for concussions. They can protect the person from skull fracture, that is for sure. However, because concussions are mostly caused by head rotations, when you wear a helmet, it in no way affect your head rotation, particularly the type of head rotation that you got hit after you got hit on the head. So that is a big problem of the helmet. It tends to give people a lot of false security.
Huh. And Professor, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds in terms of the biology of the brain, but the brain basically floats inside the skull, right? So you can't stop the brain from moving if the body and the head comes to a stop very, very quickly.
That is correct. However, the fluid, cerebrospinal fluid, cushions the brain. That situation causes one really important piece of information from physics. That is linear acceleration in terms of actually moving the brain. That is not a very effective mechanism of injury. Most of the injury, especially concussion, is due to shear forces or stress and strain of the brain.
But this is what the NFL is struggling with right now in collegiate football, right? I mean, this notion of what more can be done to protect the brain. Are you suggesting that maybe the answer is we can't really do all that much more?
The current technology of helmet, I think you're absolutely right, cannot do very much more in terms of protecting the player from concussions.
So where does that leave the NFL?
I always have a personal opinion. I think if you look at rugby, rugby is quite a physical game, except in rugby, players do not get concussions nearly at the rate as American football. I think one of the major reasons is that when you look at the sports of rugby, even the audience, do not like to see what they call high tackle. So when you tackle a guy, you tackle normally the player below the shoulder. And occasionally when somebody accidentally perform a high tackle, the audience actually boos. But in American football, the culture is that when you hit somebody, you gotta hit them so hard so that he won't stand up again. Mm-hmm. So I think if you ask what can we do, what can NFL do, we have to change the culture.
By changing the culture, are you suggesting there's a different way to play the game that's not as violent that might lead to greater safety?
Well, I would imagine so. So, for example, if NFL tomorrow starts to outlaw hits above the shoulder, I think that will immediately have a huge impact on player safety. But I think NFL would have other considerations as well. For example, what happened to their pocket?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just asking for your opinion here. Given what you're saying, is the NFL ultimately doomed?
I don't think so. I think American football is one of the most exciting games as there is. Out of a typical 2 to 3 hours of time that people glued in front of the television set, the statistics have shown that the action minutes of an entire football game is no more than 12 to 15 minutes. So when you think for that 12, 15 minutes, you can get a whole bunch of people glued in front of the TV for 3 hours. Man, that's just exciting.
Yeah. Kaysen, going back to the popularity here of flag football, which is what we're talking about, the Sports and Fitness Industry Association is saying that among kids 6 to 12, flag football now has emerged as the most commonly played form of the game. And it sounds like, based on the numbers you're seeing through the Y, that sounds right to you.
Yeah, I would say that is correct, yes.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, our flag football league's 5 versus 5. So we play on the field's 30 yards wide. So it's a very fast paced game. So there's a lot of playing time for everybody. And it looks almost like a little mini track meet with how fast these guys are moving and running and trying to get as many plays in. So I think it's really going to help the fitness level of all these kids.
Do you think sports like flag football, Kaysen, have become more popular since people have become more aware of the long-term effects on the head from contact football?
I think that's what started the popularity. And then I also think it's not only just the concussion thing. I just think that everyone's starting to realize, like, man, I can really develop my child position wise by playing the sport. And we offer it year round too. So like, even if you were a tackle player, maybe you play flag football in the spring, summer, and winter months with us.
How concerned are parents, Kaysen, these days when it comes to the safety of the sports their kids play? Are you getting more questions today about safety as you go through your work week?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's always been a very top concern for all parents. And, you know, we don't allow any contact with flag football, and our penalties are very harsh. Like, for example, if a defensive player accidentally hits an offensive player, that's basically a 10-yard penalty and an automatic first down. And kind of as mentioned, these games are very fast paced. So that penalty is a very big penalty. And same thing with offense. If offense makes any kind of contact, that's a loss of down and 5 yards. And you only get so many downs to get down the field. So any penalty is very costly. And I think it really teaches the kids, like, hey, I can't put my hands on this player. I can't do X, Y, or Z, or it greatly affects my team's performance.
I also can't help but wonder about the liability that the Y might face if someone who, you know, is exercising there through flag football or anything else suffers a concussion or a serious head injury. What are you dealing with there, and how much concerns get expressed to you about this?
I think at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what sport you do, you kind of are risking the chance of having contact or having a concussion thing. I think we're trying to make the game as safe as possible, and parents see that. And, you know, to be honest with you, the 7 years I've been here in the Kansas City Y, I haven't seen a player have a concussion playing flag football. And I think the only way they could possibly do it from watching it is if they dive for a ball or something, they hit their head on the turf. So I think we're doing the best we can, and the parents are seeing that.
Professor, what do we know these days about the numbers of kids who suffer concussions from playing sports or even contact sports? What are we seeing out there?
The ratios in various different sports, the National Federation of High Schools keep track of those statistics. Typically, for example, a high school football player, the average chance of that particular football player to get a concussion is roughly about 10% per person per season. For a female soccer player, that percentage is roughly almost 9%. And then wrestling is also very high, slightly above 10%. But those are the troubling spots.
Those numbers strike me as, those are higher numbers than I would have guessed, Professor.
The odds seems bad.
Yeah. Kaysen, you actually have a flag football partnership with the Kansas City Chiefs. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so they're actually one of our great partners that we work with. So they've been with us for about 2 years now. So they do a lot with us. They actually help provide us with uniforms for all the players that have a big Chiefs logo. They also provide medals and stuff for all of our participants. So, and they're actually pretty hands-on. Like sometimes pre-COVID times, they had players come out and the cheerleaders would come out and meet the kids. Really? Casey Wolf's come out multiple times. So yeah, they are very hands-on. And then when schedules allow it, we normally do like a big tournament at the end of our seasons. And normally we hold our championship games on their practice facility over by Arrowhead. So they've been nothing but a great partner for us. So, and they've been very hands-on, and it's pretty fun. Whenever we played at the practice facility, sometimes the Chiefs players are working out inside. They'll come out and meet some of the kids and take in the action. So yeah. They've been nothing but great to us.
I was going to say, what you're offering may be more important than ever, because sometimes kids aren't doing recess these days at school, given the COVID pandemic and everything else. That only adds to the importance of what the Y can bring people.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I don't know if you've driven by a school during the recess time, but it looks really sad right now.
Wow.
So, you know, what we're being able to offer a program like this and giving these kids an opportunity to be face to face with a great volunteer or someone that they can look to as a leader that's not just mom or dad, is, I think, going to just help them grow through this very tough time right now. And just being able to keep these kids active. I coach a couple of teams, and when I was able to work with them, you could really tell they needed it. They needed to be able to burn energy, and you could tell they probably just kind of sat around and played video games the majority of the shutdown time. So they were itching for it.
Well, bottom line here, flag football may be a very safe way to go for kids who are thinking about getting some exercise. That was the voice of Kason Matthews, a senior sports director for the YMCA. Professor Chi-Min Huang also joined us. He's a neurobiologist and a professor at the UMKC School of Biological Sciences. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, that's it for this week. Have a great weekend, all. We'll see you on Monday. You've been listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske.